Hello, and welcome back to Bench to Bedside. I'm your host, Dr. Susan Firth, Executive Vice President and Chief Scientific Officer of the Research Institute. CHOP's first centers of emphasis were created some time ago to strengthen our understanding of childhood diseases and help us catalyze our impact on child health. Joining me today is Dr. Håkon Håkonarsen, the founding director of the Center for Applied Genomics, as we refer to as CAG. And in my perspective, CAG was really ahead of its time in leveraging new technologies in understanding the human genome and how genes are expressed in order to further our understanding of genomic contributions, both to rare diseases, but also to more common complex diseases of childhood, such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, asthma, autism, diabetes, epilepsy, and others. It's been a remarkable journey for you. You come from Iceland, and I understand you trained here and then went back, and then you came here again to CHOP to establish the Center for Applied Genomics in 2006. Can you tell us about your path that brought you here in the early days of the center?
It was actually an interesting journey because I trained here as a pediatric pulmonologist from 1992 to 1995. And then I became a faculty here at Penn as an assistant professor in pulmonary medicine. We were only five faculty in pulmonary at that time. I think we have 30 plus today. In 1998, I got an opportunity to go to Iceland and take a leadership role with building the genomics database of deCODE in Iceland. It was an opportunity that was really one of a kind. But at the time, I just got an R01 on my first shot, and I managed to actually keep the grant. I came to CHOP every few weeks to manage my research for 6 years. And I was an officer at deCODE in Iceland. Then when the technology was sort of changing, I just happened to be asked to give a grand round here at CHOP around 2004. I told the audience about all of these discoveries we were making in Iceland, because Iceland is a very unique patient population. We have a genealogy for the entire nation, so we could generate huge family pedigrees and look at how genetic information flows from one generation to the next and make discoveries that nobody else was able to make in the world at the time. But the technology was changing, and I left the audience by saying, because now we are just about to get so-called genovite association SNP arrays with hundreds of thousands of markers, you can now start doing the type of research we are doing in Iceland in individuals who are unrelated. And then Steve Altshuler calls me up, who was the CEO at the time, and basically said, I heard good things about the grand rounds you gave. What would it take to bring you back and lead Genomic Center here at CHOP? He reached out just like 6 weeks later and said, the board approved everything. When can you start?
Wow.
So I came in May of 2006, and only a few weeks after I came, because we were really well prepared in terms of setting everything up, we generated more data in 1 week than the whole Research Institute had in its total. We did that in 1 week, and we had to figure a way of getting access into a cable and getting the data up to Norristown in a data center, because there was no infrastructure to keep it. So that was a huge enterprise to take care of. That's how it came about.
That's a great story. I didn't know all the details of that before. So CAG really stands out because it's such a remarkable resource, both for biologic samples and then all the data that's been generated from diverse populations. That's a huge strength. You were using and continue to use cutting-edge technologies to better understand genetic contributions to disease. Can you describe for our audience the variety of approaches that you're using now?
We started with these SNP arrays because they were state of the art at the time. They were just coming out, and we were the first center to scale the array up to the size of the lab that we built at CAG.
And can you tell people what's a SNP?
So SNP is a single nucleotide polymorphism. These are changes in the genome. So the human genome has 6 billion bases, 3 billion base pairs, half from the mother and half from the father. And every 200 to 300 base pairs, there is a wobble. There are four bases, very simple, A and T and C and G. And instead of A, you may have T, or instead of C, you may have G, and that can change the amino acid and can change fundamentally how a protein or a gene operates. Now, some of these SNPs on the SNP array, they are built to capture the building blocks of the genome. So you could find the location of a gene, but you didn't necessarily know what was wrong with the gene, or if there were many genes in the block, you had to do other omics approaches to get there. Sequencing was very early on at this time. We started implementing sequencing maybe about 3 years after we started the SNP array. And sequencing allowed you initially to sequence a series of genes that was not possible before, because the first human genome was only completed in sequencing around 2000. And it costed $2 billion to do it. Mm-hmm. Today, we sequence sometimes 20 or 30 genomes in one day for about $700. So it's come down immensely. But we started with these panels, which included 10 genes or 50 genes. Then we ultimately went to what we call a whole exome. So that's like all the coding sequences, all the genes in the genome. And they're about 18,000 to 20,000. So we could read these sequences SNP by SNP and find any of the changes that would happen in any of the genes of the genome by doing these exome sequences. Whole genome sequencing became a few years ago much more popular because it's much more comprehensive, gives you every single base pair in the genome. So whether there is this sort of wobbles where you have A instead of T or G instead of C, you could also look for what we call structural changes. So there's a deletion or missing piece, or there may be a duplication or insertion. All of this can duplicate a gene or delete a gene and can cause a disease. Obviously, when you have a variation, which is every 200 to 300 base pairs, and you have 6 billion base pairs, you can just imagine the complexity of analyzing just a single genome. It's really complex. So that's why we built these informatics pipelines, as we call them, where we have developed software to really automate and get all the information captured from the genome just in 1 minute, essentially, for a genome. So it's quite remarkable how things have evolved. Currently, we provide these services through CAG to essentially all faculty at CHOP and Penn. This now goes beyond panels and exomes and whole genomes to sequencing the RNA, so-called RNA-seq, and sequencing the RNA also down to a single cell level. So then we sequence each and every cell, and we know, because sometimes you have acquired mutation, and they may only affect one particular cell. And if you do sequencing with exome or genome, you may totally miss it, because that cell may be very rare, and you only have a few copies of it, so you miss it, basically. It's just like a noise. So if you focus in on sequencing at the high level, every single cell in a specimen, you can get much more granularity and information. This is really becoming, just in the last 2 or 3 years, the most popular sequencing we do at CAG today, the single cell sequencing. And then we can assess for methylation, we can assess for histone modification, all of these modifications of the processes, they change the way the gene functions. And this is critical, critical information in any discovery or any development today, because all bodily functions and diseases, you know, are on the basis that our genes are functioning properly.
For the audience, so the methylation, when you talk about that, it helps figure out what gets turned on and what gets turned off and what gets dialed up or dialed down.
Right. So if you methylate a sequence in the DNA, it turns off the gene. So you shut down the gene. So the gene may be very important in development, say through puberty or through development of a certain state. So many genes, they need to be shut off, because when you have developed through a certain state, it would be pathologic if they continue. So the body shuts them off, but then sometimes they do it inappropriately, and you therefore shut something off that should be on, and you may develop a disease.
Right.
And there are many, many diseases that are known to be attributed to methylation.
The tools that have evolved and that you're using in CAG to understand the unique signatures of a disease are really remarkable. And I know that CAG has done a lot of work in the biorepository to be very thoughtful about the diversity of the individuals who've consented to have mm-hmm. their genetics studied. One of the contributing factors to the diversity is the eMERGE research projects that you've been part of and been a leader of. Can you tell us about the eMERGE research projects and what those are?
We built CAG to recruit anyone who wanted to participate in the beginning. And so we got a cross-sectional area, if you will, of the population at CHOP. And naturally, when we recruit, it's just about 50% individuals of European ancestry. It's about 37% African-American, which is really high. And it's about 5, 6% of Latin and Asian ancestry and a couple of percent native admixed individuals. This was really attractive to this eMERGE network that started back in 2006, but they started it off only with adult projects. When they started seeing publications coming out of CAG, we have published enormous number of papers, it's actually over 900 papers today, they started realizing that we were publishing papers selectively on African-American patient population. And so we got into the eMERGE relatively early, around maybe 2010 or 11, and we have been a solid member of eMERGE since. This is a consortium network funded by the NHGRI, which is one of the NIH Genetics Institute. And it funds 10, 11 sites, of which we are one. It's actually only one other pediatric site, which is Cincinnati, but multiple other adult sites. We have worked together now for the past decade and more enriched the patient populations with minority patients. And that has been a very high focus in eMERGE. Currently, we are looking at what's called polygenic risk score. And polygenic risk is more important for common complex diseases that don't have a monogenic or single variant that causes a disease like sickle cell disease when there's just one mutation, or a single gene like cystic fibrosis, although there may be multiple different mutations in the gene. Polygenic risk takes into account all the genes that contribute to a particular disease. This could be asthma, could be diabetes, could be obesity, epilepsy, and the like. We abstract the information from these genetic variants, and they accumulate because there are thousands of markers that inform and contribute to the network of genes that underlie these diseases. This is now the focus of eMERGE 4, the most recent group, and we are charged with recruiting 75% of patients of African-American ancestry. And we're the only site that can do it. No one else can do that. That has been a major asset and contribution to the eMERGE network. The network has been very successful. We published hundreds of papers together, and this is all collaboration with all the sites always involved in every single paper.
That's terrific. And that, unfortunately, historically, individuals who've been part of research studies have not been as representative of the population at large, and that's led to our conclusions about what works or what doesn't work or what causes are right. often incomplete.
The inequity in research has been very significant because most of the research conducted and funded by the NIH has actually focused on European ancestry. This is now finally changing, but not everybody can really change it because they don't have the assets or resources to do it. Here at CHOP, given the patient population that we serve here, we are able to do it, and we lead that effort completely.
Yeah, it's a major contribution. You described how the technology has advanced. It's just a rapidly evolving field. Every year, new things come out. Can you reflect on, in your career, and some discovery or real advance that was memorable using these tools, a success story?
Probably the most memorable is the discovery we made in the generalized lymphatic and vascular disorders. This was a few years back. We were studying patients with a complex vascular malformation. And those can be very deformative. They can be so extensive that these patients, they leak fluid all over the body, so it can be lethal. We had a boy from Virginia who had been back and forth here to CHOP that Dr. Dory was treating with cauterization and trying to burn these overgrowth of vessels that just kept leaking fluid everywhere. This patient was getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And I just happened to be on service for the pulmonary division at the time when he comes in on a weekend, and I'm consulted. I told the family that we were working on this research project, if they wanted to participate, just to let us know. And they elected to do it. Then we actually identified the mutation in this patient in a gene that was involved in a pathway that had never been described to be involved with this condition before. It's a mutation in a gene called ARAF, and this was in the RAS-MAP kinase signaling pathway, which is very well known in cancer. But this is not a cancer. This is an overgrowth condition. So we made that discovery. We happened to find another patient with exactly the same mutation, who was a little older patient that came from the lymphatic consortium that we were also collaborating with at the time. We took the mutation to establish that it was causative for the condition. We put it into a zebrafish, and the zebrafish developed swelling and edema, overgrowth of the lymphatic and the vasculature. MEK is the signaling molecule in this RAS-MAP kinase pathway that was highly, highly phosphorylated and set on. There are MEK inhibitor drugs that were approved for melanoma actually only in adults. After establishing this causality both in the fish and also in the cells from the patient, we applied then for IRB approval to treat this patient, and we filed a single IND to the FDA, both of which were approved, and we started treating the patient. It was just transformative in terms of the lymphatic vessels that were all torturous and leaking fluid everywhere. They reformed into normal lymphatic system. And what we know now, we didn't necessarily know exactly at the time, is that the drug actually kills off mutated cells, which are in a very often low percentage, but they drive the disease process. And it kills off those cells, and the normal cells, they grow and create a normal system again. Lung function in this patient was around 20% and tripled just in a matter of a few months. It was totally life-saving to the patient, and we have now treated about 30 patients where we have found mutations. These are all acquired mutations. You're not born with them. They're only present in certain cells. So getting a blood sample and trying to look at it, you will never come up with a finding. You have to get fluid, isolate specific cells, or now we're isolating cell-free DNA because these cells, they shed into the bloodstream, circulate, they release the DNA, and we can capture this tiny little bit of DNA. Now with the modern technology, sequence the samples not 50 times, which is the standard, but 50,000 times, we can pick up really rare mutations that no one knew about before and find what causes this and guide therapy. Absolutely transformative in terms of these patients.
That's a great illustration. Truly personalized medicine.
And just one other, because I'm from Iceland, and there I have a niece there who was diagnosed with a lethal disease, but we developed therapy here for it, which has kept her alive now, 6 years today beyond what would have been expected. This is a therapy because this is preventing amyloid from precipitating in the brain and clogging the vessels that we are now developing for Alzheimer's disease, because the pathogenesis is very comparable. And USA Today picked this up as one of the most innovative development in Alzheimer's disease. Finding that at a pediatric hospital and maybe having a therapy in the future for Alzheimer's would be a big deal.
That's a huge deal. Right. And I think that as a believer in the remarkable impact that research in children can have, that's a great example, because there are many diseases or mechanisms of disease that present in children. Well, this has been terrific. I learned a lot and really exciting work, and I hope we get to do this again.
Yeah, appreciate that. Thanks so much.
Please join me next time as we explore our first centers of emphasis and how they've grown. For more stories about the people of the Research Institute and the incredible work that they're doing, visit our blog, Cornerstone, at research.chop.edu/cornerstone-blog. Thanks very much.